From claims of healings and visions to the world's most inexplicable events, whether you're a believer or a skeptic, the truth is always worth the hunt.
EWTN Radio presents The Miracle Hunter with Michael O'Neill.
Welcome to the Miracle Hunter Radio Show on EWTN Radio. This is Michael O'Neill. I'm the Miracle Hunter. We've had big news these days in the miracle world, and that relates, of course, to that incorruptible nun that was found in Missouri a week or so ago. And the news is big. Washington Post has contacted me about it. Numerous people have been in touch, and you'll be seeing a new segment coming out on EWTN News In Depth, where I'm interviewed. People are fascinated by this concept of incorruptibility. There are so many people who are traveling, even across the country, making a little pilgrimage to that shrine of, or that convent of Benedictine nuns there in Missouri to see this. And it's a remarkable case because we have the investigation underway, perhaps, or the morticians at least, who are looking on a local level and just seeing if there's anything. We wouldn't call it a hoax, but we'd call it a preservation of some sort that had been at some point along the way. And the current reports are no, there's no natural explanation to what's going on. So we're curious about, will the church continue its own investigation? Will a sainthood cause be spawned from this over time? We'll see. But people are interested about the phenomenon of incorruptibility. Just what is it anyway? And I always do this talk where I talk about miracles being a little bit complicated in different ways, and incorruptibility is the most interesting and complicated of all miracle types. And we'll be joined by Hannah Brockhaus of Catholic News Agency, who will be joining us. She's a Vatican correspondent there to talk about the Church's longstanding position on incorruptibility and how it all works. So we're really excited about that. And we have a big-time interview for you today. I'm really excited about this one. People who tune into the show, my friends, know that I love Padre Pio. He consider him to be perhaps the greatest modern miracle-working saint. I was there for the 50th anniversary of his death there in San Giovanni Rotondo. I've been there with his relics that appear incorrupt anyway. And he's been a great inspiration for me, and Miracles of Padre Pio is a popular show that I put together. But there's a new film, I'm sure you've heard of it, Padre Pio, which stars Shia LaBeouf. You know him from various big-time films, and he's going to be coming on the show today. So he'll be talking about his role in that film, and Abel Ferrara, the director, will be on as well, and Brother Alex, who was a member of that production as well. So this is going to be a three-person interview talking to us today, with us today, and so excited to hear what Shia has to say about how that role changed his life forever. And check out my latest book, Science and the Miraculous, How the Catholic Church Investigates the Supernatural. It's out from Pan Books, available at EWTNRC.com. For people who want to know more about incorruptibility, that is my best chapter in the book, so check that one out. Science and the Miraculous. There's a lot about that phenomenon there. Later in the show, we're going to be taking a look at the 365 Days with Mary Project. We've got Our Lady of Vladimir from Moscow in Russia in 1395. And the might-be saint of the day for today, June 3rd, is Blessed Diego Oddi from Italy. And the question of the week, are all the miracles that I show on the Explorer series Vatican approved? I'll try to answer that question in just a little bit. Let's take a look at the miracle news. We do this every week where we talk about the miracles happening all around the world, those things that relate to miracles. People can find out more if they go to the Facebook page of The Miracle Hunter. I pick all my stories from the ones that I post on there. The most popular ones are the ones that make it on the show each week. And there's a very fascinating story this week, and I hate to laugh because I don't think this would happen in many other countries. It has to be a very Catholic country, I think, for this sort of thing to happen. But of course, the Philippines is maybe with Poland, those are the two most Catholic countries in the world. Brazil might want to argue differently, but I think that it's an interesting thing what happened. There's a Marian apparition that was claimed in the Philippines in 1948, and it's gone through an incredible process. It's called Our Lady of Lipa, or Our Lady Mediatrix of All Graces, and I've been there. I've traveled to the Philippines to see it. It's a long flight, and it was actually approved as supernatural by the local bishop and then condemned by the Vatican, and prior to that it had been condemned by the Vatican, so it's gone through some rough times. But with all those approvals and condemnations, you might find a split nation in the sense that half the country believes that it really did happen and the other half believes that it should be condemned and shouldn't. And it's a very Catholic nation, so everybody's Catholic there, or many people are Catholic there anyway. And so there was this very strange story recently that there was a Dominican exorcist priest. His name was Father Winston Calabing, and from the Manila Diocese, and he was arrested on May 13th for allegedly, quote-unquote, offending religious feelings when he purportedly called the apparition there demonic. And so the judge who asked that he be, who was arrested until May 21st, and she is a Catholic who is great, has great interest in Our Lady of the Mediatrix of All Graces, Our Lady of Lipa. And so she accused him of being too negative about this condemned apparition, or at least apparition that's has no found to be no supernatural character to it. So so it's Harriet Dimitro is the judge. She complained against Father Calabing and said the Philippine hierarchy are spreading lies about the apparition. And so the Philippine hierarchy had to come out with a statement clarifying and apologizing for not being more clear over the years and allowing the devotion to persist, even though it is not an approved Marian apparition. So that's the very strange miracle news for this week. For more miracle news, perhaps more upbeat stuff, you can go to miraclehunter.com. You can go to the Facebook page, and you can get miracles loaded there each and every day. Let's take a look at Catholic Club Trivia. We do this every week, where we ask a trivia question and give out a prize to an emailer who gets the right answer. And this week, we are talking about incorruptibility. So the question today is about that, and that question is, what 3rd century martyr is thought to be the very first incorrupt saint? Again, we're talking about incorruptibility today. What 3rd century martyr is thought to be the first incorrupt saint? If you think you know that answer and want to win the prize, the image of the faces of Mary, send me an email to miraclehunter@ewtn.com, or just go to my website, miraclehunter.com, and answers and winners will be posted on the show page on miraclehunter.com. We need to take a short break, but when we come back, we've got a big-time interview for you. We'll be talking with Shia LaBeouf, the star of the new Padre Pio film out in theaters this week. Stay with us for that.
Now, back to the Miracle Hunter on EWTN. Here's Michael O'Neill.
Welcome back. You're listening to the Miracle Hunter radio show on EWTN Radio. This is Michael O'Neill. I'm the Miracle Hunter. People who listen to this show know that I love talking about saints. And so people always ask that question, who's the greatest miracle-working saint? And I can't help but answer the great Capuchin friar Padre Pio. And I have a great personal devotion to Padre Pio. I pray to him every time I need something really big. And I was even there in San Giovanni Rotondo in 2018, filming a program, Miracles of Padre Pio. I was there for the 50th anniversary of his death. And today we're so excited about a brand new film called Padre Pio that's coming out in theaters, release date being June 2nd. I'm sure you've heard of it. Catholics and otherwise are really excited about this film, perhaps because it's the reentry of Shia LaBeouf into the film sphere, but also because it sheds some light on the life of Padre Pio. And we're so excited today to be joined by the director of that film, that's Abel Ferrara, and brother Alex Rodriguez, a Capuchin, who plays Padre Pio's friend and confidant, and he was a spiritual consultant on the film as well, and also Shia LaBeouf. Who, of course, as you don't need, needs no introduction because of his many great films. And so a little background on the film, of course, is that it traces a very important time in history. this intersection of the time right after the World War, and the life of the Capuchin friar at around the age of 33. And so this is a pretty interesting way to present it. It not only focuses on Padre Pio, but it not focuses on the war, it's kind of interweaves the two. And just a quick disclaimer or word of caution for those people who are looking for a family-friendly hagiography or saint biography, a saint-like depiction of Padre Pio, this might not be it. So this is a gritty, esoteric, kind of in the line of all of Abel Ferrara's other films. And Abel, I think this is just what we might expect from you. So I think audiences need to buckle up and be ready for this film. But it is sure a good one to watch. And so for today's interview, we'll be speaking with all three guests today. And we'll start with Brother Alex. And Brother, please just tell the audience, who are the Capuchins? And what was going on with the Capuchins at the time of the war in San Giovanni Rotondo? And just give us a little background on Capuchins in general.
Historically speaking, the friars before Vatican II used to live more like in a monastic setting. Our schedule was we would do mostly together. We could all the hours, so the liturgy of the hours, the divine office, the prayers of the church. And sometimes the guys, the brothers, would go out and do their particular ministries. Padre Pio, when he was moving from Pietrelcina to San Giovanni Rotondo after a number of years of living with his family because he was sick, he became responsible to take care of what was considered or called a seraphic college in San Giovanni at the Friary. So in other words, it was high school students who were preparing for entering the Capuchins after they graduated. So that's not in the film, but that's the history of that, of how the Capuchins used to live back then.
Wonderful. And Abel, of course, when you created this film, most people will see the title of the film, Padre Pio, and they're going to think it's focused solely on the great saint. What inspired you to run the two stories together that are so distinct in parallel, and how does that actually work for this film?
Well, you know, it's called Padre Pio because that was the inspiration, and that's the, you know, the life force driving it. You know, Pio did not live outside of the events. You know, it was a very small town. You know, he was there serving Mass. He was there listening to confessions. He was very part of that, you know, the moment of the first free elections, the kids coming back from World War One, the birth of fascism, what unfortunately ended up in a massacre of 13 people, which for Italy, for these cats, you know, on a non-mafia situation, a political situation, it was unheard of. And this is in the period that he had his stigmata, which it was not, you know, we discussed it. This is not happening in a vacuum. He is not living in a vacuum. You know, he's not living. He's living with the brothers. He's living in the community. And he's feeling the community, you know, because of his sensitivity and just the you know, the man he was.
To add up to Abel's thing is that Padre Pio at this time, when he was in his early 30s, in the friary, he had little contact with people outside of the friary, maybe hearing confessions every once in a while, maybe doing a Mass. So the movie shows that this is the introduction towards which every other ministry he did after the stigmata. It's when he starts to get to know the people of San Giovanni Rotondo at this time after World War One, during the social political issues of the town.
Now, Shia, I'm sure when you signed up for this film, you maybe didn't know what you were getting into. Maybe this is a little bit different being in a monastery than your usual past experiences on film sets. Talk about the experience, what it was like for you coming from past projects into this one.
More freedom, very intimate. You know, not even the subject matter, just the way Abel gets down. You know, he's Abel's a very, very singular type of talent. He's not even a talent. He's a singular type of artist. He works a very specific kind of way. Felt very intimate, like a boxing match would feel intimate. Felt like a very close quarters, small crew. We had our people around us to sort of buoy all the madness of the subject matter, because there was madness. It was full-blown madness, you know. Go in this room and, like, fight with the devil was a crazy prompt. You know, go in this room and, like, you know, he's having visions now, right? He's being got. I mean, these are things that they're really hard to conjure type of things, you know. And the reason Alex was so important to me is because Alex had very, very, very grounded stories about his encounters with the devil and the supernatural. And, you know, by the time I had heard these stories from Alex, I really trusted his sensibilities, and he's a very honest guy. And the way he would describe him to me felt really grounded. And then when you deal with the subject matter, you know, I've never dealt with a movie that has higher stakes. This isn't just like you're making a movie about a person who has a fan base. You're making a movie about a person who is sacred in the eyes of many, and you really don't want to get it wrong. And a big reason why I needed Alex around me was I needed to, it's like a little kid. When you take a little kid to a park, it's really, you feel safe to explore things that otherwise are very, very scary as a performer and as a human being and as a Catholic. And so I felt very protected.
Yeah, it sounds like an incredible life-changing experience for you. And we're talking today about the new Padre Pio film, which is going to be out in theaters and video on demand with its June 2nd start date. And so we're talking about some of the very difficult scenes that came up for you and Abel. And one of those scenes was where Padre Pio is battling the devil. I mean, that's a rough scene. It's a tough scene to watch, tough, of course, for Padre Pio to go through, first and foremost, but tough to watch for the viewer. Now, that kind of identifies three different worlds that we're dealing with, the devil praying to God and interacting with the people around him. How did you kind of weave these three worlds of Padre Pio together in telling this story?
You know, all three scenes are coming from his letters, okay? So he's very specific. First, he writes beautifully. He writes poetically. And, yeah, like Shia said, it's very grounded. I mean, he's very clear on what he's seeing and what he's feeling. Okay, but, you know, now we got to pull it off, you know. Yeah, I think we stayed true to his language, and we stayed true to how he presented it.
One of the things about this film is you present Padre Pio from the point of view of him as a man versus him as a glossy image of a saint. What motivated you to take that approach more on the humanity of Padre Pio versus his saintliness?
I mean, he wasn't a saint. You know, when he was 33 years old, he wasn't a saint. He was doubting, you know, everything. He was being confronted by everything, and he didn't have the answers. You know, he was struggling for it. That's the point of the movie, you know, and the end, and the ending of the film is his confirmation, you know, and his belief. The struggle is like for all of us. I mean, it's a struggle. It's a blood struggle, man. It's a battle. And it's every moment, it's every day, and you have to have the belief. And some of us get there and some of us don't, you know.
The beauty of the film, Michael, is that it's showing to the world something that was not spoken as openly before. And unless you look at the history of San Giovanni, unless you look at the letters of Padre Pio, it's like who was Padre Pio in the midst of all of the suffering from World War One, from the people of San Giovanni, from his own personal sufferings? And you see that in his letters, and it shows Padre Pio's humanity in a way that you wouldn't have thought that he was a suffering servant, really. So his temptations, his encounters with the devil, with his openly saying that at one time he lied as a priest before receiving the stigma. So like all these events as that you see in his personal life as he talks about it or writes about it in his letters, shows the humanity of Padre Pio as somebody, and as Abel puts in the film, somebody who's striving and wanting to be holy, that the saint that we know now was a sinner too, as all of us are.
That's very well put. We're talking today about the brand new Padre Pio film out in theaters and video on demand as of June 2nd, and we're all excited to see that. And Chaya, I've heard you say that you're in RCIA and on your way to becoming fully Catholic. Congratulations for that. We're all excited and praying for that. That's amazing. Padre Pio, as you know, is known for his great devotion to the Eucharist, which Catholics consider to be the source and summit of the Catholic faith. And Padre Pio actually has a few quotes about the Eucharist. He said it would be easier for the world to exist without the Son than without the Holy Mass. And also he said at Mass, "I'm consumed with the fire of divine love." What was it like for you to portray a man with such conviction saying Mass?
You know, Pio's also got great quotes where he's like, keep your heart in the sky and your feet on the floor. So, you know, yes, a man who really had a relationship with the sacred, but he was a very pragmatic, practical guy. He was a workhorse. You know, he really did the work. He was really feet on the ground. He was on the front line of this. He was sitting confession for hours and hours and hours and hours. It wasn't just like, he wasn't just a mystic. He was also like a roofer. He was like a blue collar worker. He wasn't just a mystic. So that was really important for me. And so when you walk into the Mass as a person who comes from a secular background, me and Alex had spent months like going to different traditional Catholic Masses in Oakland, in Los Angeles, in Italy. We went to a lot of traditional Latin Mass, and you know, I was watching it not even from the perspective of a Catholic. I'm watching it from the perspective as a performer. And Pio, when you watch all these Masses, then go back and watch Pio's Masses, it was the greatest at Mass. He was just the greatest priest to ever serve Mass, in my opinion, and in my ignorant tippy-toeing into the faith, because it was so personal. It was so rooted. It was so internalized. He wasn't, like a good actor, he wasn't doing much. The good actors don't do much. And when you watch Pio's Masses, they're full of deep, deep emotion, and he's not doing much. He's really in a full-blown love affair with Christ while he's serving Mass. You know, and so when it came to doing Mass with Alex, we had to learn the dance moves, of course. You got to learn the moves. You got to learn the language. You got to learn where to stand, where to put, what to hold, how to hold your fingers, what it is you're actually handling. The incredible nature of the task is overwhelming until you break it down. So we broke down Mass into dance moves, and then from the dance moves you get into the language and the meaning behind the Latin, and then you're into something different than just a dance. You're into something that's deeper than a dance. You're into a story. And now you couple those dance moves with the narrative of it all, and then you got to personalize it all. So there were steps with how with which we had built this Mass up. And again, if you're going to play Bob Dylan and you don't know how to play the guitar, fire yourself. If you're going to play Pio and you don't know how to run Mass, you have no right to be doing this. And not only, and to run Mass properly, you have to be fully in love with Christ. And so there's steps to this. And it was like, you know, For such an overwhelming task as to run a Pio Mass, which he's, you know, it's historic. There's legends of his Mass. You know, it was very scary till you start breaking it down in phases of preparation, and that's how me and Alex did it. We broke it down into phases of preparation.
I'm sure you felt you'd never quite get it. You can't do it just like Padre Pio did it, of course. But at what point did you feel like you fully understood his character enough to do that Mass properly for the film?
When I got lost in it, when the crew disappeared, when the film set disappeared, when the laity disappeared, when I was looking at the host and seeing Christ, I get choked up about it now. When you have an emotional connection to the Mass, for me, that's what I saw in Pio's Masses. I never actually got to Pio's Mass. I got to the best version of what we could create. And I'm not an ordained priest, you know. I can't even have the host. You know, I'm not confirmed. So it's you know, for me, when there was a point in the shooting process when, and Abel's really good at this, you know, heart in the sky, feet on the ground. He's very good at being a cut man, and he's also very good at giving space to the sacred. He would let me pray for elongated periods of time, and he would sneak up on me with the movie. That's kind of what the mass felt like. He would just let me run mass, and then he kind of snuck up on me with the movie. I didn't know we were filming at a certain point. I was just running mass with Alex, you know, and right before mass, I would look to Alex and I would say, I love you so much, Alex, and just sort of tap into something like animal, like deeper than logic, deeper than movie, deeper than psychology, deeper than head, deeper than intellect. And then, you know, when you're in these churches that he really served mass in, you can get lost. You start looking up and you'd like teleport. You have these time teleports. You look up and you're looking at the same ceiling he looked at, and it's overwhelming. It's overwhelming. And so, you know, I was in a complete state of psychosis at a certain point when we arrived at.
Well, that's a great breakdown. I appreciate your insights on that. And as we wrap up the interview today, Brother Alex, what's your hope for Catholics as they see this film, learning more about Padre Pio and increasing their devotion? What's the big takeaway for you for this film?
The biggest takeaway really is to see Padre Pio as an example that there's purpose in your suffering. There's purpose in your suffering, and then in the end goal is obviously your salvation, but also to serve. I mean, to help one another out, well, others who are suffering as you are in whatever circumstance you're in.
Wonderful. Abel, you took on a tough project here, and what do you hope for will be the result of this effort? When people walk into this film looking for a saint biography and might be surprised by what they learn about this film.
This was a man, you know, living his life. And, you know, and if they just feel what you heard it from Shia. That was what was brought there, and it was brought there because, like you said, we're in places that were really there. There's people in that mass that might have even been in Pio's mass. You know, we weren't filming a mass. These people were experiencing a mass. There were brothers in that church. And, you know, there was the brothers with us, the Capuchins there, Alex and his group, our sponsors. It was just, I just wanted to feel that. I just hope that they open enough and not be cynical and not, you know, just open their hearts and minds to it.
Absolutely. And Shia, congrats on landing what is perhaps the role of a lifetime, in my opinion. It's incredible, especially what it's doing for your faith, and best wishes and going forward with that. And for you, what's your hope for people who walk into this film?
Sometimes Christ feels so far away. Almost impossible to achieve any, you know, perfection. And so what these saints do for me, and what Pio specifically did for me, was he made me feel like I could identify. And so what I hope this movie does is they show a very human, very flawed man who became this thing, became this ordained, beautified priest, and that route towards salvation is also offered to them, that is possible.
Thank you so much. Beautiful reflections from all of you today. Thanks for being on the program today. And people can check out the film as of June 2nd in theaters everywhere and video on demand. Thank you to all three for your interest and devotion in Padre Pio, and best wishes on the success of this film.
Thank you, Mike.
Thank you, Mike.
God bless you.
God bless you.
We need to take a short break, but when we come back, we're going to be looking at the question of the week. Stay with us for that.
Now, back to the Miracle Hunter on EWTN. Here's Michael O'Neill.
Welcome back. You're listening to the Miracle Hunter radio show on EWTN Radio. This is Michael O'Neill. I'm the Miracle Hunter. I love getting your questions. People write in from around the world with questions about miracles happening in today's world and those that have happened centuries ago. And when I give a talk, I give maybe 20 talks a year, traveling around the country to different conferences, parishes, events, and give a talk on miracles, of course, of Marian apparitions, Eucharistic miracles. And people have lots of questions afterwards, which I love. And people email me from all over the world about their questions. So I got an interesting question today, which is a lot of fun for me because it's from a viewer of the show Explore with the Miracle Hunter. It says, "Dear Miracle Hunter, I quite enjoy your show, Explore. I'd be very appreciative if you could answer two related questions I have. One, I believe watching your show that the miracles you report have all been approved by the Vatican. And two, would you know of a resource where I can get a list of all the miracles that the Vatican has approved or miracles by each country? Thank you very much, Tommaso." Well, thank you, Tommaso, for your question. And when we talk about the approval of the Vatican, it's a complicated thing in each type of miracle. And so on the Explore show, we show all kinds of miracles, some things that come to us down from pious tradition, like the flying image at Genazzano, the house of Loreto, things like this, the stigmata of St. Francis and Padre Pio. We also do the various apparitions of Mary. So there are different types of investigations and approvals, and sometimes the church weighs in on these things, and sometimes they don't, and sometimes they're in process. But in general, we try to present those cases that are the most famous ones, and they're most famous, perhaps, because the church has gotten behind them with support. And normally, the local bishop is the one to do the investigation. It's the he sets it all up, and then he goes through the process and releases a statement if it's worthy of belief in the supernatural character of the events. And that's how that devotion gets propagated. And at some point, the Vatican may step in and show some sign of support, and those signs would be a feast day, the canonization of a visionary, if that's appropriate, if it's relevant in that case. Perhaps it's a visit of a pope to that shrine. It's a prayer composed by the pope. It's some other sort. Golden rose is a way that the pope will also show recognition. So these are all signs that show that the church is behind a given devotion. And so, in many of these cases, we have these golden roses, these visits of popes, these big signs of the Vatican. There could be a feast day, but they're not all the same. They haven't all received those various checkpoints. But to answer your question, we always try to present those cases that are most recognized by the church, both the authority of the church and the faithful. We haven't presented any cases that have been condemned or are really in process too much. We presented one case from 1947, Tre Fontana. The Pope has shown some signs of interest in that case. John Paul II did, and there's various approvals that have happened, but never a formal declaration of supernaturality of those events. So that was the only one that was a little bit different. But in general, we've seen all of those to be highly approved cases. So great question. And just quickly to answer your question, where can somebody go to find a list of all the Vatican's miracles? Well, the Vatican doesn't even keep such a list, and maybe the only place you can go is my website, miraclehunter.com. Check that one out. I've got lists for stigmatics and apparitions and Eucharistic miracles and sainthood miracles and the whole deal. So check that one out for a list of miracles from all around the world. Thanks for your question, Tommaso. Let's take a look at the 365 Days with Mary project. Each week we do this where we talk about the Marian devotion of the day as it relates to the day's date. So we all know Fatima, May 13th, or Lourdes, February 11th, or Guadalupe, my favorite, December 12th. And so for today's date, we've got Our Lady of Vladimir in Moscow in Russia in the year 1395. And the Mother of God of Vladimir is an icon of the Eleusa type, or tenderness type, and it's one of the world's most beloved and well-known Marian images. The Virgin of Vladimir is said to have been moved from Jerusalem to Constantinople in the year 450, and when he became ruler of Vladimir, the prince brought the temporal panel from Kiev and placed it in the Dormition Cathedral. The end of Tamerlane's siege, a miracle commemorated annually on September 8th, the birthday of Mary, is credited to the icon when it was carried to Moscow in the year 1395. After a victory over the Tartars in 1480, Moscow became the permanent home of the image. The icon hung in Moscow's Church of Annunciation until 1918, and on June 3rd or May 21st in the Julian calendar at the time, this remembers Moscow's deliverance from Khan Mehmet Giri in 1521. And that's the fascinating devotion of Our Lady of Vladimir from Moscow in Russia in the year 1395. And for more information on this devotion or any of the hundreds of other Marian devotions from around the world, you can connect to the 365 Days with Mary project with the website.com and go to the Facebook feed and join 10,000 other followers. Or you can pick up the book or download the free app, 365 Days with Mary. Let's take a look at the sainthood news. We always talk about those who might be saints, and that ties in with my television series, which airs on Fridays on EWTN, about Americans on the path to sainthood and the search for canonization miracles. And I always like to give you some hints of who's coming next in the sainthood news. And it's always kind of interesting to me. Every month or so, the Pope gets together with the prefect of the dicastery for the causes of saints. He just did that several days ago, and he met with His Eminence Cardinal Marcello Semeraro. And during this audience, the Pope authorized this dicastery to promulgate various decrees, including the heroic virtue of the servant of God, Simon Mapecki, known as Baba Simon, a diocesan priest born around 1906 in Batombe in Cameroon. And he died on August 13th in Edea in Cameroon. Now, he was a diocesan priest. He's the very first Cameroonian venerable. He distinguished himself for humility, prudence, and piety. And he carried out his ministry in a multi-ethnic neighborhood in full demographic expansion and was very involved with the young people. His knowledge of several languages showed him to get in touch with the local people and their interests. So that is the might-be saint of the day, that is the sainthood news for today. That is a future saint with one miracle, he'll become blessed, and a second miracle will lead to him being named a saint. Now let's take a look at the might-be saint of the day. We talk about this where each and every day on the calendar year, believe it or not, there's a different person on the path to sainthood whose feast day or death anniversary lines up exactly to that day's date. And for today's date, we have a Blessed Diego Oddi from Italy. And he was the son of Vincenzo Oddi and Bernardina Pasquale. He was raised in a poor but pious farm family, and he had very little education, but he learned as much about the faith as he could. About age 20, he felt a call to religious life, but his family strongly objected. He met Blessed Mariano da Rocca Casale while making a pilgrimage to Rome and was inspired by his example to become a Franciscan lay brother. He spent the rest of his life in the same monastery, and he was known for his life of simple service, his sunny temperament, and his obvious deep faith. And, of course, I mentioned he was born in 1839 in Valfreda, but he died in Bellegra in Italy of natural causes. And he was declared venerable by John Paul II and beatified after that as well by John Paul II. So in Rome in 1999. So that is the might-be saint of the day, Blessed Diego Oddi from Italy. And with one more miracle, he will be declared a saint. We need to take a short break, but when we come back, we're going to be talking with Hannah Brockhaus about one of the most fascinating types of miracles, incorruptibility. Stay with us for that.
Now, back to the Miracle Hunter on EWTN. Here's Michael O'Neill.
Welcome back. You're listening to the Miracle Hunter radio show on EWTN Radio. This is Michael O'Neill. I'm the Miracle Hunter. Now, people talk to me a lot about a certain phenomenon in the church. Maybe they talk to me about all kinds of interesting stuff, Marian apparitions, weeping statues, stigmata, and the like. But one of the things that comes up a lot is, believe it or not, people want to know about incorruptible saints. And I've traveled the world, and I've seen many of these alleged or perhaps real cases of preservation of a saint beyond what would be expected. And so various places in Italy, you can go to San Giovanni Rotondo and see the preserved body of Padre Pio. He looks amazing. He's got a silicone mask on, and his heart is incorrupt, but the rest of him is not. You go to Nevers in France, and you can see St. Bernadette Soubrou, the 14-year-old visionary of 18 visions of Our Lady of Lourdes, and her body is in a near state of incorruption. Absolutely amazing. And there are various other saints who have different levels of preservation, you might say, and some are preserved for just a few years, some are for centuries, some are totally preserved, and some aren't that preserved, and some are preserved in sort of a half state, you might say. St. Catherine of Siena, for a lot of people, she's a tough one to look at. She's probably had better days. But as far as incorruptibility goes, it's such a complicated phenomenon. We wonder, how does it all work? And so the reason incorruption comes up on this show, I could talk about this every year if it were to come up, but it's such a rare thing because there's a seemingly incredible discovery in a Benedictine monastery in rural Missouri recently, where the body of Sister Wilhelmina Lancaster, she's a Benedictine, she's the African-American foundress of the Benedictine Sisters of Mary, and she appears to be in some sort of a state of preservation. She died at the age of 95 in 2019, so very recently, so 4 years ago. So, of course, this idea where we open up a tomb after, 400 years and we see somebody in a remarkable state, that's more noteworthy. But even considering 4 years, that's what the various inspectors who have looked at her, and they have said that this is remarkable. So I think that it's a great time to sort of answer the question, what is incorruptibility anyway, and how does it all work? And so there's an amazing article that's out on Catholic News Agency. You should check this one out. It's kind of an explainer. It says, what is incorruptibility? Here's what you need to know. And it's written by Hannah Brockhoff, and she is here today to join us on our program. Welcome back to the show today, Hannah.
Thank you so much, Michael.
Now, you are the Vatican correspondent for Catholic News Agency, and you write numerous articles all the time. I love reading your articles, but this is one of my favorites, and this is maybe one of the best that's out there right now that explains all the details of this very complicated phenomena of incorruptibility. And so if we just ask the question, it's probably an unfair one, but what is incorruptibility anyway?
Right. That question opens up kind of a can of worms, as you got into a little bit with your introduction, right, about there could be so many different levels or states of preservation. So very generally speaking, it's the preservation of the body from the normal decay after death in kind of an unexplainable way, a way that we'd say wasn't explainable by the conditions of the grave or modern embalming or whatever the case might be.
And I think it's interesting, too, because some people might expect that incorruptibility might mean that once you open the coffin, then the body stays perfect forever. But it seems that maybe incorruption is more of the finding of the body, the state of the body, and then some kind of preservation at that to preserve that remarkable occurrence is okay. So it's a little unclear. The church doesn't have any sort of formal start or end point of how long incorruptibility has to last for it to count. So it's kind of an interesting phenomenon, but we do see the bodies of saints around the world, and that gives us inspiration and faith to see what real saints looked like. But a lot of what we know of incorruptibles comes from that classic book, as you identify in the article, Joan Carol Cruz's The Incorruptibles, where she identifies 100 saints, and maybe there are more than she's got. At least I found a few more since she wrote that book in 1977. What would you say that is the way the church identifies an incorruptible at this point?
Right. Well, because we don't have a cut and dry definition, there isn't such a necessarily formal process in place. From what I understand, it isn't quite like the process we have for declaring someone to be a saint, for canonizing or beatifying someone, where there's such clear steps written down. This is the process, and here is the investigation they do into a possible miracle that could lead to their canonization. Instead, it's kind of maybe less structured. So it's up to probably the diocese, the local bishop of the place, and then if they need to, they can get the Vatican involved. But it's a process of determining, is there any natural explanation for finding the body to be in the state that it was found in? Is there, could it be the state of where they were buried and the air quality or the coffin at the time of their death? Were they embalmed or were there any other preservation techniques? So it's kind of both looking back into records, maybe of when the person died, as well as examining the body.
Yeah, I think one of the interesting ironies in all of this is that the rule book for sainthood and the rule book for incorruptibles is written by the same person, the future Pope Benedict XIV, Prospero Lambertini, who wrote all this down. And one of the things that I thought was interesting about what he wrote in his book, De Cadaverum Incorruptione, he says that incorruption is not to be used for sainthood causes, only in exceptional cases. I guess I don't know what that means either. I don't even know if he lists out what that is. But most people will say that, like the finding of Sister Wilhelmina, does this mean that she's a saint? Is this a sign from God? No, the Church doesn't necessarily use that as a miracle for canonization. Perhaps it is a sign, though, of some sort of a blessing. So, what are these common objections that's made to the idea that that the body must be preserved, or et cetera?
Well, it is just like you said, that the future Pope Benedict XIV wrote on that. And, he said that, it's because a person's holiness doesn't depend on that, right? So it can't be one of the criteria for determining holiness, whether they're present in heaven, because not every saint who has been exhumed, especially usually around the time of a beatification, shortly before a beatification, if it hasn't happened before, a saint candidate's body will be exhumed. And so that would be one reason why it's not considered necessary for canonization. But it is true that in from kind of a popular piety perspective, it does feel like a sign to us, doesn't it, that someone had an extraordinary amount of holiness. It does feel that way because it does feel miraculous, especially as has been reported with some, that there might not be any bad smell coming from the body, or even that there's even a perfumed smell coming. I think it's good to, obviously to be very clear that doesn't mean, okay, now, Santo Subito, this person is a saint. There still needs to be all the process of investigating their life and looking into their holiness. But
that's right.
That,
I say it doesn't count for sainthood, but it goes in the sainthood file, right?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. It's still, I think it's still such a remarkable sign, and I think it can be just, like many other miracles that happen in the Church, or, alleged miracles, even before they are possibly declared, to be officially a miracle by the Church, it can still be something that supports our faith as well as Catholics, something that inspires us.
Absolutely. We're talking today with Hannah Brockhaus about, she's a Vatican correspondent for Catholic News Agency, and she's got this incredible article about what is incorruptibility. Find it on CatholicNewsAgency.com, along with a lot of her other articles as well. And so one thing that I thought was kind of a fascinating thing that you brought up in the article is about if there has been preservation, does that exclude incorruptibility? So, again, if the tomb has been opened and the body is found perfect, and everybody's pretty excited about that and they want to keep that look going, guaranteed, so there is some preservation. I think that happens quite often, actually. I think that might be the standard practice. I know that Joan Carol Cruz puts the number pretty low, that 1% of her 100 incorruptibles have received some intervention, but at some point I think they do that just to keep the look for the faithful who want to see the saint as they were found. Does that exclude the concept of incorruptibility?
No, it doesn't. The Church kind of, like you said, looks more at how the body was found originally. So the truth is that there are a lot of incorruptible saints, and some of them whose bodies are still displayed, who the look has changed over time. So maybe it was recorded to be in a certain state when first revealed, but hundreds of years later, maybe the skin has darkened, or any other, you know, natural processes can happen because of the exposure of the body. And so, you know, Cruz, at least she argues that, you know, down the line or after that discovery of incorruptibility, if some steps are taken to preserve the body, that doesn't exclude the fact that they were incorruptible.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think when it comes to Sister Wilhelmina from Missouri, she's a fascinating case. It's very early on. She just died recently, 4 years ago, so she hasn't had to deal with the same things as the other incorruptibles, who may be incorruptible anyway. But one of the things that's fascinating about her is she did not go through some of the condition, or she went through conditions that might lead to deterioration. It's been the case of numerous of these incorruptibles. I think it's worth mentioning that there are skeptics out there who say, well, these are just like the mummies of Mexico or other places of dried out places. But there have been places where there's been dirt graves, wood coffins with decay and deterioration, and they've been found in water or mud, things like this. And these are not conducive to mummification. So we've seen that. We've seen some remarkable things happening, including in this case of Sister Wilhelmina. What do you think is going to happen with her body? What, are they going to initiate a sainthood process as a result of this, do you think?
You know, it's a little bit early to tell, but I wouldn't be surprised if they do. Obviously, that has to wait till about at least 5 years after the death of someone to officially open that. So we're only at 4 years. So maybe in 1 year, you know, they will do that. And it'll be very interesting to see. Like you said, these cases of there have been cases of incorruptibility where saints' bodies were not in in conditions conducive to mummification. For example, I just wanted to point out that Saint Charbel Makhlouf in Lebanon is just one more even recent example, probably one of the, at least as far as I'm aware, one of the most recent examples we have in the church. That would be from the 1800s of a saint who is found incorruptible.
That's right. He's an incredible miracle worker and, yes, an incredible incorrupt body as well. Now, this is a fascinating phenomenon. I think that maybe Sister Wilhelmina, because of all the internet attention to her, even Washington Post is doing an article on her, I know, and maybe that will lead to the growth of the cultus, the devotion that they need to launch the canonization anyway, so or the cause anyway. So we'll see if this gets off the ground. Well, we're so grateful to you, Hannah Brockhaus, for the Vatican correspondent for Catholic News Agency, for writing this article and for joining us today to talk about what is incorruptibility. Thanks so much for being with us on today's program.
Thank you.
God bless. That was Hannah Brockhaus. Great interview, talking about that most difficult of miracle type, in my opinion, incorruptibility. Well, it's one of these questions of, you know, when we get to heaven, we'll ask God what he was exactly doing with this. It's a little bit complicated in so many ways. But this is a fascinating story that people, even in secular media, have been contacting me about, this story of Sister Wilhelmina in Missouri. And that's all the time we have for today's show. If you missed any of this episode or want to catch up on past episodes, you can go to EWTN.com/radio and check out the audio archives or download the free EWTN app. I'd like to thank our guests, Hannah Brockhaus from Catholic News Agency, and also Shia LaBeouf and Abel Ferrara and Brother Alex for joining us to talk about the brand new Padre Pio film. And check out my EWTN television series, Explore with the Miracle Hunter, on Saturdays at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, and my book, Science and the Miraculous. It's available from Tan Books and available from EWTNRC.com. I'd like to thank you for joining me today on Miracle Hunter. We're from claims of healings and visions to the world's most inexplicable events. Whether you're a believer or a skeptic, the truth is always worth the hunt. Talk to you next week.